Well, welcome to our viewers out there. This is our Men of Nerds interview with Mark Van Steenwyck. And today we're going to be talking about A Wolf at the Gate, this great book that he's written. Let me tell you a bit about Mark, and then we'll get into our discussion. Mark is the co-founder of the Mennonite Worker in Minneapolis. He's a writer, a speaker, activist, and grassroots educator, working with groups to help them live more deeply into the radical implications of the teachings of Jesus. He's contributed to a number of books and is the author of The Un-Kingdom of God, That Holy Anarchist, and the book we're talking about today, A Wolf at the Gate. He currently serves as the organizer for Carnival de Resistance, a traveling carnival, village, and school for cultural transformation that is coming to Minneapolis in September 2016. So, welcome, Mark.
Thanks for having me.
Well, we're happy to have you. I'm told that you're a Menno nerd.
I am.
What's that mean to you?
I don't know. I thought about starting a splinter cell called Menno Geeks, but I decided not to. No, what does it mean to me? Well, to me it was kind of, I got involved because I'm really not from within the Mennonite kind of background, the tribe, and Menno Nerds kind of has this fusion of kind of more of an Anabaptist focus, and I am a nerd. I was a nerd before it was cool to be a nerd, so those two worlds combined. And so I thought, count me in.
Well, speaking about nerd, from your bio, we know that you live and work in Minneapolis. Maybe you could tell us a bit about your upbringing, where you grew up. Tell us a bit about yourself.
Yes, my upbringing. I was one of those kids that stayed inside and read books when other kids were out playing kickball and didn't understand why I didn't have more friends. But that's where my love for learning started as a seed and grew into a mighty oak. I grew up in rural Minnesota, and actually in my teen years I had a conversion experience at a Bible camp. It's the same week that I met my future wife. I met Jesus and Amy the same week, and I was really fundamentalist for a long time. And just to kind of jump ahead in the storyline, when I was in my early 20s, when 9/11 happened, I saw the reaction to war. People were like excited about kicking some Muslim butt, you know, and there was a lot of, to me it seemed really demonic. For the first time I saw it as a demonic thing, this lust for war. And so in a troubled way, I kind of went back to the Gospels, read them. And at this time, I was planning on going into the Air Force as a chaplain. So I read it. I was in Luke's Gospel when I realized, oh no, I think I'm a pacifist. And so kind of everything was a slippery slope from there. So that's the nutshell version of my background, my Anabaptist origin story.
I find it interesting that you said, 9/11, was it immediately like that, 2001, 2002, or was it later on when people started to get disillusioned with some of the campaigns?
It was like within a couple months. People were, because, remember that weird patriotism influx that happened, and I would have thought of myself as patriotic, but that paired, I was kind of uncomfortable with that for some reason that I didn't understand, but when I saw people being like really getting excited about engaging in war, that march to war, when everyone was excited, to me that just woke something up in me. And so I became really, suddenly found myself anti-war. Even like a couple months before, I was still planning on becoming an Air Force chaplain. So that's why it's around that time, it was just months later that I started seminary. So my whole plan was to pay for my seminary through chaplaincy.
Wow, that's quite the transformation. Well, what can you tell us a bit about your current family and living dynamic? Like, what's your life look like now, today?
My wife, Amy, and our son, Jonas, who's 8, live in a big old house in Minneapolis with currently just a few other people. In the past, the Mennonite Worker has had up to 3 community households. Right now we have 1. And up until recently, we had a couple guests living with us, but we're actually entering into a season where we're not having house guests. And by guest, I mean pretty much strangers who we didn't know before they came to us. So for most of my son's 8 years, he's lived with a rotating assortment of community members who are part of our community and various guests. So
has anyone ever like kind of asked you like, oh, isn't that dangerous? Isn't that, you know, kind of precarious? Yeah.
Yeah, people used to ask that all the time. But we're not usually dealing with emergency situation guests. Usually there's some sort of word of mouth and some sort of connection. And then also we just used to always tell people this, like it's not like we're asking random people to babysit our kid. Like he's not being unsupervised with house guests in, you know, in an unseen room. It's just, you know. In fact, his room, in order to get to it, you have to go through my bedroom. Up the stairs, there's an attic stairway in our bedroom that leads up to the attic, and he has a little attic room. That's where his son lives. So
you can keep your child in the attic? Awesome. Yes.
He used to live in a big walk-in closet. So, I mean, if without context and seeing them, I mean, it could just, that doesn't sound very good, but they're really big rooms.
good. So what can you tell us a bit about like some of your work? Like you mentioned like in your bio that you founded the Mennonite Worker and you do something called the Carnaval de Resistance.
Yeah, so the Mennonite Worker part, that's basically kind of an intentional community situation. We used to be called Missio Dei, and we changed our name to the Mennonite Worker largely through the encouragement of our Catholic worker friends, which is a similar setup of hospitality to strangers. Mm-hmm. But we've also, through it all, had our own worship services, so we're a Mennonite congregation. So we're kind of a hybrid of Catholic worker and Mennonite congregation. And we've, you know, we do workshops and trainings and activist-y stuff and meals, things like that. But a little less than a year ago, I went on sabbatical. I kind of hit the burnout wall, which is not fun. It's kind of you know, anybody in any kind of ministry tends to hit that wall at some point or another. And so things kind of came to a pretty big standstill. And so as we're kind of imagining what's going to come up in this next decade of ministry, I got involved with the Carnaval de Resistance, or De Resistance, which is Tevin East and Jay Beck out of Philly. They put this carnival together, and I'm working as the local organizer to bring it to Minneapolis. And so it's really hard to explain what the carnival really is, because you have to, if you haven't experienced a carnival, it's like this ancient or a medieval kind of Christian tradition of people dressing up like with animal masks and stuff, and everything's all topsy-turvy, and then you have like, you know, in the Middle Ages they'd proclaim like some town fool as the king of fools, and they'd make fun of their actual king, and people just have a wild time. That's where the Mardi Gras traditions come from, is from the carnival. And so the way we're taking that is just to have, we set up for 2 weeks, a two-week residency, where we have this performance piece that's, performance is centered around the four elements of earth, fire, air, and water, but then drawing from the biblical prophetic tradition. So Jay, like in one thing, he has like a skull mask with antlers that are on fire, and he's prophesying doom. Or they...
That's going to freak some kids out, let's be honest.
Yeah, it's a little intense. More gracefully, when Jay and Tevin are doing the air piece, Tevin is dressed like a dove, and Jay is dressed like a raven, and they have this engagement with singing and dance. And then there's a midway out front of the big top where there's different games. And there might be people dressed up, stilt walkers, magicians. It's just a carnival. But all of it is really an experiment in radical discipleship, calling people to sort of the ancient, to engage God in kind of the fringe, marginal sort of place, in the strange place, the prophetic place, and reconnect with the earth and with each other in a way that is outside of empire. So it's this real radical, awesome, creative burst, and that's why I got involved with it.
Yeah, and you kind of mentioned like your process joining that was coming a bit out of like burnout, do you feel like this kind of stokes a bit of creative juice in you, or?
Yeah, to me, it's, you know, it's kind of cliche. I just turned 40 in January, and so you start thinking, am I really living into the edge that God wants me to live into? Mm-hmm. And I realized I was getting close, probably closer than a lot of people. I mean, I'm kind of doing the radical thing, but I realized that for me, the growth edge is creative, imaginative work. And so this really hit that spot.
Well, speaking of that, you have a new project that we're here to talk about today. I'll just flash it on the screen for everyone. It's this great book called A Wolf at the Gate. Mm-hmm. And it's kind of not like anything you've done before. For anyone that's kind of followed your work as an author, published two previous books, The Un-Kingdom of God and The Holy Anarchist. And, you know, those are great books, but I don't think they really appeal to the same kind of audiences, and they're not the same. What can you tell us about, you know, what inspired you to branch out and reach a different demographic and a different writing style?
There are two things. One, the nice answer to that is, you know, since he's been born, as long as he could sit still and listen, I've read to him every day. And it's kind of something I look forward to. And anytime I tuck him in, I'm going to read as much as I can to him. And I realized that the really adventuresome, exciting stories tend to have lots of knights and pirates and violent figures in it. And so I started going through the lists of nonviolent books they recommend for young tykes, and most of them are boring. Kids don't want to read about how Gandhi did stuff. They want to, if Gandhi were a wizard, maybe.
Yeah, that's true.
Or if MLK were a sea captain, then that might be interesting. But the kids usually want fanciful, imaginative stuff. So I knew the story of St. Francis and the wolf, and so I tried to tell him that story. And the way it's mostly told is the wolf comes running out to snarling, and St. Francis makes the sign of the cross, and then, Jesus, magic happens, and everybody is friends. I'm like, no, I'm going to rewrite that story. And I'm going to rewrite it and tell what happens after that, the wolf becomes friends. And I'm going to tell it from the perspective of the wolf. And I'm going to throw in a bunch of subversive stuff in there. and part of the reason I felt, the second reason that isn't as kind of a little more cynical is, at that point I was like, you know, it gets tiring trying to convince adults of things when they, by the time you're an adult, you're probably, your imagination quotient is kind of set. You're either imaginative or not. And if you can't functionally conceive of how a world could be different, then I'm wasting my time with you. So I'm like, I'm going to go and try to subvert kids because their imaginations aren't yet rigidly formed. You can still expand their minds so that when they're an adult, no matter what they think of as an adult, also they still have this big imaginative potential. And then if I talk to them then maybe they'll be like, yeah, okay. So I'm like, I'm going to change my tactics a little bit and start focusing on the places where imagination is possible.
So you're probably banking on, in, you know, maybe 20 years, there'll be all these hippie kids that grew up and they're all adults now. They're like, oh, yeah, like Mark Van Steenwyck, he taught us good. We all have imaginations. We're all
yeah. Wrong. There'll be some 20 years from now, like there'll be a bunch of revolutionaries, nonviolent, hopefully, revolutionaries with a wolf gate tucked into their back pockets. And they'll call themselves the Order of the Red Wolf.
That'd be great.
That'd be awesome.
T-shirts, because you gotta have T-shirts, right?
Or little black berets with a red wolf emblem on them.
All right, I like that. Very subversive.
Yeah.
Well, I've got like two kids of my own, and I also like read a lot of kids' books. Like I look forward to reading my little Olivia. She's about 2 years old now. I read her books all the time, and I also volunteer sometimes at our local school division, so I'm reading, like, you know, all sorts of levels mm-hmm. of kids' books, and I'm usually unimpressed by them. Like, kind of, I share your sentiment. They're usually pretty boring, they're pretty trite, they're full of, like, inconsequential, lame lessons and mm-hmm. trite moralism, but I didn't really discover that when I read your book. I was actually quite overjoyed to kind of discover some depth there. I was actually, I couldn't wait to just find out what was going to happen, and I was on the edge of my seat. I was like, oh no, is the Red Wolf going to turn and eat these outlaws and all sorts of things. When you wrote this story, you know, what were some of the themes and truths that you were trying to convey to your readers? And yeah, and what were you trying to put out there? Because I really see A Wolf at the Gate is kind of a very parabolic story. Mm-hmm. It has lots of analogy, and it seems to capture something a lot different than, you know, just like telling kids this is what you should believe, right?
Yeah, and so in a way, it fits within the genre of a fable or even a morality story. So there is a moral in the story, but usually these morals to stories kind of lack complexity. So what I wanted to do is try to get at what does nonviolence look like, but a nonviolence with teeth. I really believe that nonviolence is only authentic when you're in a situation where violence would otherwise be considered a viable option, right? Mm. So if you're having to choose not to be violent and instead be nonviolent, that's a real nonviolent moment. If it's easy to be nonviolent, like it is in our country, there's no cost to it. So I wanted to create a story where this wolf would, if the wolf did turn on people and start attacking people, that if you're reading it, you think, yeah, that makes sense. But I wanted to then change the direction of it. So I wanted to get at that. And in order to get at that, I had to get at some of the roots of violence. So from a wolf's perspective, she's upset because of environmental degradation. Like, her food supply has been cut into by the expanding territory of mankind or humankind. Mm. There's also, I address issues of economics and politics, and it's only like 70, it's like a 80-page book, and 20 of the pages are pictures, and so I wanted to get at complexity, but not have a very wordy book. So one of my favorite reviews, I think it came from Publishers Weekly or Kirkus, they said that I had muscular prose, which was like, yes, I succeeded. The sentences are, they're straight to the point. It's really direct. But underneath it, there's this complexity. You can tell that things aren't simple. And I wanted to get at that. So to me, I've had some of my friends tell me this is my most theological book, which I first thought was insulting because I've written two books about politics and spirituality for grown-ups. But I think it's true because I think this invites you into an imaginative place more than my other books have. So it's a gateway drug. It's a gateway drug to the kingdom of God.
Oh, yeah, that's good stuff. You know, I was once told that, like, truth can arrive incognito within a story. Mm-hmm. And I often think that, like, such the power of this book is that it arrives in a narrative, right? And you're captured by the story, and maybe because of that, you're way more willing to entertain some of those, you know, presumptions that you may have, right? How do you think that narrative is, like, more useful for you to, you know, arrive and communicate themes to your audience rather than, like, I mean, you could potentially write a young book, just, you know, a catechism class. You could have written that, but, you know, why use narrative rather than, you know, cold syllogism.
Mm-hmm. I've come to the conclusion that most people don't change their mind unless they want to. Mm. I've never really met anybody, or myself have I ever, like, had someone convince me, and then for that reason alone I changed my mind. Usually there's something emotional or psychological going on underneath. And so to me, a story does is it provokes within you a longing for something different. You want Narnia to be real. You want Middle Earth to be real. And because there's some subtlety, in, like, especially in Tolkien's writing compared to Lewis's, about the values and virtues of that world, when you discover them, you think you're discovering them yourself. You don't realize that Tolkien has put that in there for you. So when you come to this conclusion that agrarian lifestyle is better than an industrial lifestyle, He never says that in The Lord of the Rings, but it's kind of obvious if you're an adult. But when you're a kid and you read it, you start having this desire to sit in the Shire and smoke pipe weed or whatever, you know?
And have, like, mead and wine.
Yeah, mead and walk around with hairy feet. You know, like, you get this kind of nostalgia for a place that's never existed. And that creates a longing so that later on, some of those people who love Lord of the Rings decide, I'm going to start a hobby farm. Now, if I were to go to them and say, and with the Wolf of the Gate, you know, there are these outlaws that live feral off the land in relationship with animals. I could write a book on why you should become part of a wilderness band of anarchists. I could write a treatise on that. No one would ever.
You could write it tomorrow, right?
Yeah. No one would. People would be like, oh, no, that's just that rubs me the wrong way. Mm. But if you create the story that's beautiful, people kind of long for it, even if they don't. Can't articulate it yet. You leave the articulation up to them, so they get to create it with you. So having it be told to them.
Yeah, that kind of reminds me of a quote from the Brothers Karamazov by Dostoevsky. He says in the book, and I'm only telling you this because I stole it off Ryan's end, but he says that beauty will save the world. And I think there's such like strikingness, like paint a picture of a new reality. And like you said, like there's that longing for something more beautiful. And I always think that like we internally know that once you know something to be true, you can't unknow it and be true to yourself. Mm-hmm. And I think that's the power of beauty, is that it always awakens us to alternate realities.
Yeah.
So we read in The Wolf at the Gate of the Red Wolf. You know, I'm going to kind of start towards the beginning of the story. And we read this kind of founding story of how she's raised. Her mother and her father kind of give her these really great myths. One's about a raven. And they're kind of founding myths that give her wisdom and instruction. And yet, as we read the story and it develops, you know, we see that conflict causes the Red Wolf to really begin. You put it in your book as she began to give way to rage. Mm-hmm. And I wanted to ask you, you know, in what ways do you think that is exactly a temptation for our generation today? Like we may have these great ideals and values, but we give way to rage and our wisdom fails. You know, how does that speak to our world today and our own temptations?
Yeah. I mean, I think on the one hand, we are given over to the rage that we have, but in some ways, I oftentimes, and this sounds contradictory, think we don't have enough rage. And let me unpack that a little bit. I think there's a rage, sometimes when you're really upset and angry about how the world is falling short of this vision, this beautiful vision, or it's pushing in on your own community so that's hard for the people you love to flourish. There can be a rage that comes out as destructive. You just want to crap on everything. Sometimes rage can be, you can channel it into creative things. And so this is, to me, why I don't like linking rage with violence necessarily, because I think there can be a rageful nonviolence that isn't necessarily bad. Like where you're angry, but anger doesn't have to be destructive. You channel it. Where I see us giving way to rage, and I see the Red Wolf giving way to rage, is there becomes this destructive impulse, like I'm going to tear it all down. And sometimes tearing bad things down is good, but if you really don't have anything to replace it with, you don't have an imagination or a constructive proposal, then all that rage all that anger and rage, well, you'll just kind of vomit it back out and you'll create the same thing that you were fighting against. And the Red Wolf doesn't quite do that. But she pushes back against humanity in a way that doesn't really help her or the wolves or anybody else. It just is pure vengeance. And I see a lot of vengeful, you see that now, especially with Trump campaign.
There's
a lot of
rage
and vengeance being kind of regurgitated out and with people that don't even know they're really all that afraid and angry. People that are so used to being afraid and angry all the time that they don't realize how they're vomiting out vitriol and disgust all over the place. Mm-hmm. So that's kind of a given overness there's the lack of accuracy where the rage isn't focused on the right things. It's kind of like, this reminds me of an interview I did once with Bruce Levine. He wrote a book called Stand Up, Fight Back. He's a therapist, and he was working with a lot of kids that are he was diagnosing with oppositional defiance. Mm-hmm. And one day he started realizing, well, maybe I, instead of trying to get them to not be angry, maybe I should help them figure out a proper target for their anger. And so he started doing some analysis with them, and he realized that they had this anti-authoritarianism that could be good if it was directed. And so he gave them political voice, and their anger focused, and they're no longer taking it out on their parents or their friends. And so I think that's kind of what we're seeing now. There's a lack of focus. People don't realize what they should really be upset about. Some people do, but a lot of people don't. They're just angry, and they take it out on immigrants or trans folks using bathrooms or whatever.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. It seems that rage sells, right? Like, it's, you know, it helps people, you know, get excited about a certain issue. Like, I think recently I heard the story that's in the news about this gorilla. I'm sure you've heard about it in Cincinnati. And we all get fired up. We all get raged about maybe the wrong things, right?
Yeah.
We have... And it seems like our media kind of feeds into that, too, right? It's just like, breaking news, this and this and this, and get angry about this. And it just seems everything is presented to us in kind of a dichotomy, and a kind of like, you need to get upset, you need to say something, but maybe not for the right causes, and maybe that just creates like a weariness in us. I'm not sure.
Yeah, it's and a certain recklessness. Like, so the media, it's so hilarious to me in a sad way how the media almost across the board can't recognize how they helped create Trump. Because they've been pointing out his bad things. I'm like, well, that feeds into an anger that people, like, it's helping it grow because you don't understand that Trump is tapping into a raw emotion. Whether or not it's logical is irrelevant. People... We do not vote logically. We do not act logically. We don't live our lives as though they're thesis papers. We react to things, and we are driven by myths. And I think Trump, in particular, is playing the American people masterfully. I don't think he's just bumbling along. I think he knows what he's doing.
Hmm.
And the media played into it.
Yeah, I couldn't agree more.
He's winning. He's winning.
Here I am. In case you didn't know this, I live in Canada, so I just feel just so blessed that I'm not in your situation. You know, I don't know. I get the option of just saying I don't care, right?
Like, yeah, you get the until Trump wants to build a wall to the north.
Yeah, that wouldn't be too good, I guess.
No, they have one in Westeros, but we shouldn't have one here. That's a Game of Thrones reference for those who aren't men a nerd enough.
There you go. So in my research for our interview, I stumbled across this like fascinating fascinating story of a young Norwegian boy who he stood his ground against a whole pack of wolves. And what he did is he blasted out Creed at high volume, and all the wolves like ran away, and the boy lived to tell the tale, thanks to Creed, right? And I'm just wondering, that should we be thankful that like the villagers of At a Wolf at the Gate did not have access to Creed and a ghetto blaster?
Yeah.
Would the Red Wolf figure out a way to get past even that, you know?
Yeah, I feel like the Red Wolf would have been enraged even more because he was a crafty one. When I sing karaoke a lot, and that vocal quality that Scott Strand has in Creed, we decided to name it Targal, that that kind of thing. So I think the Red Wolf is too intelligent to be thrown off by a lot of Targal.
That's good. That's good. But like you said, it might like just spur the Red Wolf into more rage.
Because
when I read
rage.
The book, it kind of seemed like if she was killing humans, it was like always in self-defense, like the hunters that came after her, right? And maybe this would have just sent her over the tires, like everyone.
A murder spree,
I could see murder spree, hashtag murder spree.
Hashtag murder spree, yeah.
So the Red Wolf is kind of in our story as it's developing. I guess at this point in the story, she gets abandoned and she's left on her own to survive. Mm-hmm. And this will to survive and this fear really of dying kind of spurs her on to be a bit risky and mm-hmm. kind of cross some boundaries. And then as she crosses boundaries, we kind of discover that, like, oh, she starts to live from a place of rage and violence and greed, and it feels good, right? She crosses the line. Mm-hmm. And as she develops as a character, she transforms into the Blood Wolf. And she becomes the very thing she once despised.
Yeah.
And I wonder if this is a metaphor for us today. Does our hunger for, let's say, economic prosperity, does our hunger for, you know, whatever you want to say, like land, oil, whatever you want to put in that category, does our hunger help us to forsake our identities, even if we don't realize it?
Oh, yeah. I think the initial impulse that the Red Wolf has to survive, and even the sense of anger at humanity for depriving her and her pack of their own prosperity, what they need to live. I mean, that all makes sense. But then, you know, there's this point where, I mean, her father tells her earlier on that humanity is unique among all the animals of the forest because it kills when it's not, doesn't, it eats when they're not hungry, and they kill when there's no need. Mm-hmm. Like, I can't remember how I put it, but there's this unique greediness to humanity, and she realizes that she becomes that herself. And is perpetuating this kind of same kind of spirit that she was pushing against. I think humanity, we're living our lives relatively out of balance. I mean, to me, this thing that she hates about humanity and this thing that she realizes and has shame about herself, it sounds a lot like it sounds a lot like capitalism to me. This idea that you can keep acquiring more and more and it's okay. What the difference is this village can push its territory onto Wolfland and the wolves notice. Mm. And maybe other people notice. But in our society, like, we've become blinded to, like, how this whole thing works. We think everyone can benefit from capitalism and no one is being hurt because we don't see the direct results of our actions. We think that the military is the one doing the killing. We don't really see ourselves as complicit in our use of oil. So there's kind of it's like a micro version of what we're experiencing in the world at a macro level. The greediness that we live is pushing people off their land. And so to me, that's kind of a given overness. We might not think we're doing it out of rage like the wolf is, but there is kind of, it's not an accident that all these people groups that we've robbed from, we somehow have this disgust towards as a society. Like, why is it that we have this fear of black men? Why is it that we mock indigenous people and call them drunkards? Why is it that we make fun of Mexicans and call them lazy and all this sort of stuff? We've only taken from them, really. It's interesting. There's some sort of disgust or rage that's in there.
Hunger as a means for projecting our own wants and desires on the world. It's dangerous stuff. Is there any way out of it, though? Because I often think, like, for instance, my wife goes and she buys me a shirt, and I often think, like, well, did she buy it from, like, fair trade or anything like that? Like, is there any way to really get out of the system so I'm no longer complicit?
Well, you know, later on in the story, I mean, obviously a little idyllic, and we can't really live this way. These people, these rewilding outlaws, their hard life in the woods where they live in relationship with the animals and the land, at least it points in the right direction. They first have to realize how to be content with enough. Like, I think we need to cultivate in our own societies a spirituality of enough. And it's, to me, one of the great resource for learning about this is Mary Jo Leddy, who's a Canadian from Toronto.
Oh, all right.
She talks a lot about that. She has a book about gratitude. I think is something that we lack a lot in Western society, the spirituality of gratitude. And I see that kind of pointed at by the Beggar King's figure character, and he teaches it to these outlaws. But then also these outlaws learn to have more of a direct relationship with where their sustenance comes from. And I think that's one of the big problems of capitalism is when you start thinking about where your shirt comes from, it's confusing all of a sudden. It didn't always used to be confusing. You used to be able to find that out pretty quickly. So there's just so much, the supply chain is so convoluted that anything we can do to push against that and understand the story of our stuff, that we can make better choices, I mean, that matters. And I think we should, politically, we should push back against that sort of, like, wastefulness that our capitalist system has where, you know, we've all heard the stories of having surplus grain and that's dumped into the harbor, even though there's people starving in other sides of the world. That's part of the capitalist supply chain. And since it's no longer profitable to get that grain to somebody who needs it, we're going to dump it.
Mm-hmm. And there has been, like, push back against that in society at large, right? You hear more and more about bills getting passed, like in the EU, about food distribution from food produce chains, that they're not supposed to just waste it. I mean, it seems like we're becoming more aware of it, but it seems like the more we get aware of it, the more I'm just scared about how complicit I have been, right? Like, and how, like, oh man, I didn't even think that that thing I did contributed to that, right? Like, it just,
well,
it's scary.
Yeah, and that can shut you down. Like, so I've met a lot of people that, I mean, that's the trick, is to keep walking forward and not get shut down on this stuff. Because if you let perfectionism take root, you're kind of screwed. Like, you can't be perfectionist about it. I know tons of purists who are all about living off the grid and who don't, and maybe they never will. And they'd allow that fact that they can never do it perfectly to keep them from doing much at all. Like, they have this sort of, I think that's kind of a common, that kind of apathy that we have in the society is common. Push against that.
Yeah, how would you respond to some of our viewers that might push back against, like, well, you know, capitalism? Would they say, like, oh, are you unfairly, you know, prejudicing against it? Is it perhaps just, you know, any system we use is corrupt? Is there a way to redeem capitalism, or is it effed? Yeah.
Well, that's a big question. I mean, to me, on one level, practically, it's like, anytime we start saying, well, it could be worse, that's just a really bad tactic. It's like when someone is suffering, we say, stop complaining because someone else is suffering more. That's just a way of just shutting people down. And it's just, it's kind of gross. It's like a way of justifying all kinds of abuse, and oppression has been justified that way. So, yes, maybe, like, even if I granted somehow that capitalism was the best system, it could certainly be better than it is. So let's, at least at a practical level, push against the oppressions and broken pieces that we at least can see. Now, I happen to believe that capitalism is just fundamentally flawed, and I have all kinds of reasons for that, largely based on how we think of property, like land, like how is land distributed, the ownership, and then how do we share profits among workers, like this whole idea that, I mean, amazingly enough, somehow property ownership among indigenous people is really low, and property ownership among and business ownership among African Americans is really low, even though all of our land came in from indigenous people and most of our early labor came from African Americans. So, like, obviously there was an injustice there that we never really corrected, and it's been passed on. And yet somehow we still think that Donald Trump, for example, that he is a self-made man. Like, that whole myth, we need to shatter it and recognize that the land and the workers on the land create prosperity, and we need to have an equitable system for sharing the benefits without harming the earth. And that starts pushing you into different kinds of socialism, the dreaded S word.
Oh, well, in Canada, we're all about socialism. Like, we're way more socialist than the American context, right? Like, I've got my free health care where I can go get my feelings checked for free. And, like, I was just there the other day, you know, I don't have to pay at all. Like, you know, I get, you know, maternity leave. You guys don't even have that. I was amazed to discover that. It's just something, eh? I'll just share really quickly before we move on. something that my wife and I like to do, just to kind of push back in our own small way, is we won't shop at, like, big chain places like Walmart, because, like, we just watch how they treat their employees. They pay them, like, minimum wage. You know, I heard a stat that, like, 70% of all Walmart employees in the States are on food stamps as well. And I'm thinking, how could the 13th richest economy in the world, Walmart, treat its employees like that? Like, it's just, it seems like there needs to be a bit more, like you were talking earlier, a bit more rage about that. So at least the way I try to push back at it is, I go to Costco, although, I mean, that's a big chain, but I know they start their employees out at, like, $17 an hour or something like that, right? It's actually a decent wage. So, yeah, just kind of thinking about where our money goes and what we're supporting is kind of, at least my little way of pushing back. But I remember when I was in grade school and our teacher was covering, like, Karl Marx and, like, communism. I was, like, the only kid in my class that was like, this is a really good idea. And, like, and then she's like, oh, just wait till we get to the history part. And then I was like,
yeah,
oh,
man, the Soviet Union ruined it. Soviet Union ruined it all for us. Can't even use it. The nice thing about it is now, like, with Bernie Sanders in the United States, now people can say the word socialism and doesn't automatically, it's not automatically a bad word now. So I think the generational shift has happened. Now we learn that there's like 50 kinds of socialism. Mm. And like, there's a socialism for everybody. Yay!
What always amazes me is that like Americans tend to forget like that there's this whole group of countries in Europe, like Norway, Sweden, all the Scandinavian countries. They've been like doing socialism well. Like the standard of living in these countries is like laughable compared to some of the standards you can find in America. Anyway, let's move on a bit. So in your book, we encounter this character who gives our Red Wolf a TSN turning point. His name is the Beggar King.
Yeah.
And who is this Beggar King? He kind of sounds familiar to someone I know, but maybe
kinda sounds like St. Francis, huh?
Oh, yeah, it kind of does.
Yeah.
Why did you choose to use the word Beggar King? Why didn't you just use St. Francis?
Because St. Francis has become a statue in a garden and is a saint. And so that automatically puts him in the realm of, like, kind of this divine figure. But he was a beggar, so I wanted to reintroduce the emphasis there. Most of us know he was a beggar, but for people that wouldn't, or especially children, I wanted them to understand that this is a holy beggar, which I think is an imaginatively, it's important. Important because there's a lot of impoverished people in the story, and I want children listening to the story to feel a sense of solidarity with them. I also did it because, you know, none of this takes place in our real world. I'm doing a little bit of world building. In fact, I have other stories I'm going to write where this actually exists within the same universe. So there's since there's a little bit of magical realism, the wolf. The wolf and the beggar king can have conversations with each other at a certain level. That's never really questioned. I just wanted to kind of take it a step out of the regular real world and just one step towards fantasy. But it never becomes a full-on fantasy book, but it's just a half step that direction. And there's reasons for that that become more important later on with other books that I'm writing.
Oh, I'm happy to see that you've made those choices. I can't wait to see how that turns out in your other projects. Sounds good. Maybe you could speak a bit more about, like, you mentioned how he's a statue in a garden. Like, what happens when we saint people?
I mean, we have a Martin Luther King statue in D.C. It's just a way of, once you turn someone into a hero, you get to control the narrative. Heroes are public figures. So then they become part of your mythology, and you find out what part of their life you want to be part of their hero tale, and you build a statue around it, and then you incorporate it into the mythology of your society, so they're no longer flesh and blood. So Francis becomes someone who loves animals and is kind to poor people. That's it. And so as long as he's kind of a saint and a statue, that's what he's good for. Or Dr. King once somehow became... for a lot of people, part of this kind of conservative myth of colorblindness, that everyone Everyone's the same, and it's we live in a meritocracy where everyone gets ahead based on their merits alone in our society, which isn't true. And by allowing Dr. King to be our statue and our folk hero for that, we get to erase his critiques of all sorts of things. Jesus is a great example, too. Like, Jesus isn't subversive for most people. Like, couldn't even imagine the ways in which Jesus would challenge our society because Jesus has become a dead thing.
Mm.
A dead hero that we remember in our prayers.
Yeah, I think it was actually Stanley Hauerwas that said the enemy of Christianity is not atheism, it's sentimentality.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that what you just said kind of about sainthood and kind of trivializing people's legacy totally captures that. Like, they're nice and sentimental. They're like, oh yeah, we'll never live up to that, so let's not try to make a different world. Let's get on with the business of Caesar being Lord.
Mm-hmm. That's right.
Well, in your book, I really enjoyed your choice to focus on the point of view of the wolf. It's not common when you hear that telling of the wolf of Gubbio, right? Is that the story?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. When you hear that perspective, you're right. It's kind of St. Francis comes out, he gives the sign of the cross, and Jesus stuff happens.
Magical Jesus happens, yeah.
Yeah, everything's better, right? It's more of a superhero in that, you know, kind of story than more fantasy. But I was able to, like, do a bit of research into see if anyone else had ever done that kind of from the perspective of the wolf. And what I did find was this poem by famous modernist poet Rubén Darío. And the poem is called Las Motivas del Lobo, or The Motives of the Wolf. And it was published in 1914. And in Rubén Darío's account, it's very similar to your account in the sense that and the other accounts as well, where the wolf is redeemed by St. Francis. You know, he repeals its life of aggression. He goes and he lives in the village and, you know, takes scraps from the tables of the people. But there's a real twist in the plot, is that St. Francis comes back to the village, you know, kind of years later, and he talks to the villagers, and they're all just scared again, and they tell him, like, the wolf is gone. He's returned to his old ways. And so in the story, St. Francis again seeks out the wolf. And he asks the wolf in this version of the story, okay, you know, why did you leave the humans again? I thought we made peace. And then the wolf shares his story about how in every house there was anger, envy, lies, dishonor, lust, and hatred. And the wolf just begins to, like, lament and basically have, like, this breakdown in front of St. Francis. And then St. Francis hears all these, like, laments of the wolf, and he just walks away in silence. And in the poem, we're told that the only thing that St. Francis can say is the Lord's Prayer. And it's kind of like this really haunting poem.
Mm.
And, you know, kind of in that narrative, you can kind of pick up Rubén Darío's vision of disenchantment. He's living in Latin America on the edge of the biggest outbreak of war. You know, his country is really demoralized, and him himself, as he was a bit of a diplomat, and he was just frustrated with the world. And so what we really see is, like, despair kind of pouring out through Rubén Darío's interpretation of the wolf. Well, I was happy that when I read your interpretation, I didn't find that. But what I really like about A Wolf at the Gate is it's not that the Beggar King and the Red Wolf are ignorant to the fallibility of and corruptibility of humans. In fact, what we actually see is they see it and they talk about it. And you know, the St. Francis character, the Beggar King, he just kind of nods his head and says, yeah, some people eat big meals and others eat small meals. And still others, they eat rarely anything at all. But what we don't see is our character succumbing to despair at the lack of the status quo. And I thought that really told me a lot about you as an author. And so I thought I'd ask you the question, you know, how does your hopeful vision of an alternate reality that we see reflected in the Beggar King and the Sister Wolf, a projection of your own, like, outlook on the world? You know, when you look at the failings of the world, know, how do you intentionally resist all that despair and the disillusionment that we can see reflected in the Ruben Dario narrative in his poem that he published? Mm-hmm. I know it's a lot there. So.
I think that's very well put. There's, in my mind, there's a reason why the Red Wolf is really the hero of the story, even way more so than the Beggar King. The Beggar King is a compassionate person who enters in and will walk. Like in the story, even at the end, without giving away the ending too much, he'll still engage with the rich and the poor and everyone in the town. And just be a compassionate presence. And there's, and that's powerful. But there's almost a sense of detachment with that. Like, he'll help where he's asked. But the Red Wolf is a different kind of hero. The Red Wolf is compassionate, but never gets rid of her ferocity. And so she takes, she's not, like, when that encounter where they're walking through the forest, the Beggar King and the Red Wolf, talking about the fallibility and brokenness of humanity and why they're rich and poor, mm-hmm. and why it confuses, the Red Wolf doesn't accept that the same way that the Beggar King does. The Beggar King says, this is the way it is, and I will enter into these relationships with compassion. The Red Wolf basically is a revolutionary. He says, I'm not going to accept this. And she has a choice to be able to, she confronts the injustices she sees either with violence or nonviolence, and she chooses this nonviolence that's still a very illegal and subversive kind of act, and tries to create with these outlaws who are all, they're not good guys, but they're desperate guys. And she creates with them and some of the other animals this little place where something like justice can take root. And to me, that's kind of, I feel like, what I try to do in my life. If you ask me if I thought that we're ever going to experience justice in our world, like as a whole, I would say, if I'm honest, I'd say no, but I hope we do. Like, to me, that's my Jesus-y hope. I hope Jesus does something. But I can't see how it's going to happen. I can't see how anything I would do would bring about justice or really challenge all that much. I don't really believe. Like, my hope is not found in being able to make a big difference. My hope is found in two places. One, there's kind of, I have an anger in me that'll never go away. It's kind of like the Red Wolves. It's like, screw them. They can't take this away from me. I'm going to do it anyway. Like, there's always part of that. They can't define my Christianity for me. I have a lot of friends who've stopped being Christian because they see the hypocrisy, but I look at the hypocrisy and say, screw them. They can't define this for me. I'm going to do it anyway. Like, so there's a little bit of that, but there's also this, well, you do what you can, and then you say, it's what I've done, and it's enough for me to do. And hopefully it's part of a link in a large chain that does something important. But I have no ability to see that. I'm not going to be naive about it or heroic about it. I'm just going to do it. I'm going to do my link in the chain of creating a little space where love can kind of flourish as much as that's possible. And it's still going to be broken and flawed because I'm broken and flawed. But you do it. And it's kind of a little defiant act of love. And to me, that's all. The Red Wolf does not stop the nobles from oppressing the poor. The Red Wolf only creates a small pocket of outlaws in the woods. That's all that she does. But she's still living into that vision.
That's you could could you argue, though, that the Red Wolf does more than the Beggar King?
But, yeah, possibly. I think so, because the Red Wolf also does the Beggar King stuff, too. There is a little bit of a different mojo between both of them. The Beggar King, you never know what he does when he leaves. He's probably going and being compassionate everywhere. And his spark of compassion provoked the Red Wolf. So there's still revolutionary potential there. But I also have this little throwaway sentence in the book where the Red Wolf also starts going other places. And I never hint at what she's doing. So I like to imagine I see the Red Wolf as being a little bit more proactive and foolish about what she's willing to do.
I kind of see, like, the difference between the Beggar King and the Red Wolf. It's kind of like, I could see the Red Wolf marching in a civil rights movement, whereas, like, I kind of see, like, the Beggar King kind of like, well, let's just bless everyone and not make anyone too upset, right? Like, and it kind of, part of me wonders if that's, like, a metaphor of baptizing the status quo Like, we're so eager to maintain, like, relationship with the powers that maybe we forget about challenging them from time to time. Because, I mean, if you could say anything about the Red Wolf, it's not easy challenging the powers.
No. Well, and I like to think that the Beggar King gets changed in this. Like, because in the end of the story, the Beggar King still has his community, and his community is the Outlaws.
Yeah.
So there is a solidarity that the Beggar King has, which we don't know if he was like that before or not. I like to think the Red Wolf changed him. So I like to imagine that if there's a protest, the Red Wolf is in the protest, and the Beggar King is just walking around with cups of hot soup and giving it out to everybody.
Yeah.
The cops and the protesters. But then after the protest is done, he goes back and hangs out with the protesters. That's kind of what I see the difference between the Beggar King and the Red Wolf, at least in the story.
Mm-hmm. So yeah, you were just mentioning a bit about that alternative community. You keep mentioning about these outlaws that in the story they form like their own society. And I was wondering, like, in what way do you see that as, you know, kind of pointing to kind of a different world outside of the normal world? You know, is the outlaw community a contrast of a different community, like the kingdom of God that Jesus proclaims? Or is it like a different kind of community from even what like the Beggar King would experience?
I don't know. Like to me, what they're doing is, I mean, they're pretty much doing church in the woods. Mm. Like there's even at the end, there's this feasting that they do. It's kind of very Eucharistic.
Yeah.
Exactly. And it's kind of utopian, but there's still struggle. And even have this hint that some of the soldiers from this town will come and join them because all are welcome. So there is this kind of equalizing around the table. And, you know, it's like the Hauerwas thing, like the church is the church for the world, you know, like just what the world could be. I think some of that breaks down a little bit because it's not, none of us have experienced church that fully to where it's actually like the world would be all that jealous.
Unfortunately. That's too bad. I'm working on it.
Yeah, but that's kind of the idea is the church. It's prefigurative. Like this is kind of the prefigurative mode of revolutionary community where you're trying to live now in this community like you want the world to be. So activist, like within the anarchist tradition, there's kind of prefigurative politics, which is like lifestyle anarchism. You can live differently. But there's also this kind of revolutionary stuff where you try to challenge what's broken in the system, which you don't see the outlaws doing that. But largely that's because they'll get killed if they do. So
because they're like these violent aggressors, like they come out of hiding and they're gonna get arrested and
they'll die. So some of them are murderers. Like I try really not to sugarcoat it. They're not like Robin Hood and his Merry Men. There's reasons for why they killed that were kind of pathetic and understandable, but they're still murderers. But they're able to create a community that's good.
Have you had any pushback against that? Like, the idea of, like, here are these murderers that don't go to prison.
Yeah, I got a little bit back in that, but then plus, if anyone looks at the reviews I got, one of the first reviewers for the book is a man named Bill Ayers, who most people in the United States might only recognize that name because when Barack Obama ran for president, he got in trouble for being friends with Bill Ayers. Bill Ayers, with his partner, Bernadine Dorn, started a group called the Weathermen, which is a revolutionary group in the like right around 1970 that robbed armored cars and stuff. And some of them built bombs for blowing up buildings when there was no one there. And they were never arrested for it because of the FBI didn't gather data legally. Like there was a dirty paper trail and like their evidence. So they didn't go to jail for it. This is where it gets interesting. Like, so they were never trying to actually harm any human beings. They were trying to do a lot of property destruction, and they helped break someone out of jail, all this kind of stuff that most people would think of as kind of at least violent-esque, if not violent. But after this happened, Bill Ayers became an educational scholar, a children's educational scholar. Mm-hmm. So he does. So I thought, this is the perfect person to review my book. He's kind of like the Outlaws. But he's also a kind of a leftist educational scholar. And he I feel like that's where I got a lot of the pushback. But to me, it's the same pushback as I should get for the Outlaws. It's like both of them, like, how can you allow these violent people to be seen in good light? And to me, I just think, you don't get upset if we taught Abraham Lincoln in good light, and he did all sorts of violence. George Washington. So we need to acknowledge that if you're going to start criticizing the violent, then we have to recognize that we criticize the illegitimately violent, not the legitimately violent.
Yeah, that's true.
I want to push on that. I want to push on the idea of, like, yes, I'm committed to pacifism and nonviolence, but I recognize that all this violence around us that we still weigh based on whether it's okay violence or worse violence, and I want to challenge that. I don't think that the Outlaws' violence is necessarily that much worse than the violence of the nobles, and I don't think the violence of a Che Guevara is necessarily that much worse than the violence of an Abraham Lincoln. It just depends on how you look at it all. So.
It depends on who wrote history, right? Lucas?
Yeah, and how you understand politics and economics and what society you want to see the world move towards, like all that kind of stuff.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, a part of my thinking, too, is, like, that the outlaw community was, I almost, in my head, because I'm, you know, we're interviewing for the Menno Nerds vlog cast here, I almost thought, like, man, those people are the Anabaptists and the Stonebriar people with their nice marble chapels. I almost thought, oh, they're the Constantinian-type Christians.
Yeah.
How would you kind of... You know, what was the purpose of contrasting the Stonebriars Act of Remembrance with that, you know, they build a chapel in the Red Wolf's honor, spoiler alerts. And the Outlaws, they do like a Eucharistic meal where it seems like everyone's type, like, invited, open table.
That's kind of how it works. So, like, the Red Wolf dies. That's and this is actually based on the actual legend. There's actually a supposed to be a chapel in Gubbio built for the Red Wolf, or for the Wolf of Gubbio. So they build this chapel that's clean and nice, and so that the leaders and lords of the city can feel, like, proud of themselves. But even the poor aren't allowed there. And the poor were really the friends of the Red Wolf. I see that all the time. Like, I remember I went to the Dr. King Museum in Atlanta, and there's a lot of homeless people of color outside. They weren't inside. So that was kind of part of the inspiration as we create these spaces. Like, even in our churches, we'll often not allow the homeless in. So, and, you know,
but they smell bad. And
they smell bad. Like, there's mental health issues sometimes, or all kinds of things. And I understand it, but, like, at the end of the day, like, Jesus was, in some sort of a sense, kind of homeless, or at least itinerant, and he was a friend to the rejected. And so, it's to me, the chapels we build in Jesus' memory aren't that different than the chapel built for the Red Wolf, where the people who Jesus would most identify with aren't allowed in. So, it's kind of my, kind of a tale of two churches.
One
made out of literal outcasts who take what they can and all are welcome, and they do it humbly and simply. And that's where the Red Wolf's presence is real. Like, you can tell in the last illustration where they're gathering on a fire, and you see this Red Wolf presence in the fire.
Do you mind if I show that?
Yeah, go ahead.
I'll show that. And then you can kind of see.
Yeah, that's the Beggar King telling a story around the fire. But the Red Wolf's not present in that chapel in Stonebriar.
So is that kind of like a damning critique of Constantinianism?
I just put it as a critique of just any community or congregation, no matter what they think of Constantine.
Yeah.
Who doesn't welcome the people who are marginalized and outcast?
Yeah.
Who just doesn't really welcome them. Not even just, and I'm talking, like, I've been to all sorts of kind of progressive mainline churches where they will allow those people to come in. But they're not welcomed. Welcome is that's hospitality language. That's come here. That's embrace. That's breaking bread. And I can count probably on one or two hands at most the number of churches that I've been to where I felt like outcast people and marginalized people would really be welcomed. I've been to lots of churches. So maybe I'm really judgmental. That's possible. We won't rule that out, or we have a big problem, or maybe it's a mixture of both. I don't know.
Yeah. Speaking of judgmental people, here we go. Why did you write the character Rooster Grumpus into the story?
The Grumpus?
Yeah, Grumpus the Rooster.
That is the character. Everyone wanted me to cut him out because he's kind of in the middle of nowhere. He's my Tom Bombadil. He's just this character that doesn't make sense with the flow, but I just felt like I needed to have him in there, and I still I'm not sure why. It's just my author's inspiration needed to have him. And to me, part of the reason why I think I had him in there, I knew from the beginning that there'd be a grumpy rooster in there named Grumpus.
He doesn't forget like what the red or the blood wolf at that time did, right? And you almost can't blame him. You're like, he killed, the red wolf killed his cousins, right? Like, that's...
Yeah, like, I feel like... I mean, that's really the choice we all have to make, whether or not we extend forgiveness. So I feel like there needed to be someone who's unforgiving. Maybe it just needs to... There needs to be... I wanted there to be a representation of all kinds. There's the people who maintain the business as usual, status quo still is maintained. There are the soldiers who you wouldn't expect it, who are like cops... It's like they're the cops who join with Black Lives Matter. You know, that's kind of what happened. They join with the outlaws, at least for meals. And then you have this rooster who just never forgives. So you got the whole cast of... We've all experienced all those kinds of reactions to any times we've made a mistake and try to make amends. Where some people...
Yeah, I hope that character of Grumpus, like maybe he'll speak to a kid one day where they like have this big... mess up, and they kind of think, oh yeah, even though I've got my life on track a couple of years later, there's always going to be a Grumpus. You might like sow that seed of like, even though the red wolf is a hero, often in a lot of the stories we tell, our heroes are triumphalistic, right? Like they just conquer even their doubters. It's not like Superman has very, very little bad press. And when he does, he gets over it. Everyone, you like, usually his critics get over it, except for Lex Luthor, right?
Yeah, that's right.
That's right. Never would he give up.
No.
So tell us a bit about the artwork in this book. Like, I'll just kind of flash like kind of the cover here, but it's fantastic artwork throughout this book, and it's done by a gentleman called Joel Hedstrom.
Yeah.
And yeah, where did you find this guy?
So I asked for people to submit art early on in the process. Yeah, and his artwork's great. And I got a lot of people with some good artwork, but I had, in my mind, I knew what I wanted. And someone connected me with a local guy. He's from St. Paul, just across the river from me, who doesn't illustrate books. He does poster art for, like, shows and stuff. He does tattoo art. It's just, he does art for grown-ups. But I knew that was the aesthetic I wanted. And so he agreed to work with me on it. And it was a great collaboration. Like, I am an artist, but I didn't feel like I had the chops to pull off illustrating my own book. But because of, maybe it was irritating for Joel, but I explained to him exactly what I wanted, and then he'd kind of do it. But I knew his style enough to know, like, it was a very easy process, and I got to have a lot of input. And if you look up Joel Hedstrom, Google his name with art, he'll pop up right away. He's got a very distinctive style.
I was thinking, I read a bit about him and just kind of reading up on everything around this book. And he has kind of like a Japanese influence, eh? Like
so it's woodcuts, Japanese style tattoo art. Like, it's just a stark. Uh-huh. And he does it all digitally, which was easy for formatting for a book.
Yeah.
But it definitely has a traditional woodcut with Japanese influence kind of style. And he's got tons of art that you can find that has that kind of same style. So it's really, I think it's perfect for children's books. Children like visuals that are going to like really confront them. Lots of bold colors, simple shapes. I think most artists out there, they try to draw real good, but they lack a sense of style and restraint. And Joel's got a lot of style and restraint, so it's great.
Yeah. So what would you tell our viewers that are thinking, oh, man, I need to get a tattoo of the Red Wolf? Do it, or?
You know, there was a guy, a friend of mine got a tattoo of the wolf, but it wasn't red. It was like a regular-looking wolf.
Mm-hmm.
But the same picture that you showed up earlier with the Beggar King and the wolf making amends, he got that tattooed on his arm. I have a version of it on my arm. This is a tattoo from an old German woodcut of Francis and the Wolf of Gubbio.
Nice. So you really live this story. It's like, it's on you.
Yeah, this was my commitment cut. I put this tattoo on me when I knew I was going to write that. I'm going to get if I can figure out a way to pay for it, I'm going to get a tattoo on this arm with my next children's. I have a 4-part children's saga series of novels that I want to write.
And then there'll be a day where you're like, man, I need to find some spare skin because, like, I got to write another book.
Yeah, I'll be just tattooed everywhere.
Yeah, just like, hey, you know, we won't even have to tell people, like, what books he wrote. We'll be like, and now introducing Mark with all his tattooed books. And you're like, I wrote this book and this book.
And this one right here.
Says no regrets.
Yeah. That's right.
So I also discovered a bit in my research for our project today is that there's an album that came out alongside this book. And it seems like the more I look into what you put out into this project, you really invested a lot. Like, fantastic artistry, and then here we have a whole CD of tunes. Yeah. What was the story of how that project came about?
Well, I raised Kickstarter funds for this and self-published it first, and then got picked up by a publisher. But early on, I had in my mind, like, I want to do a children's album. I don't know if it's possible, but if I raise beyond it, then I'm going to, like, that'll be my extension goal. And a friend of mine, John Felton, is part of a group called John Felton and Soulmobile, came up and asked me if he could do it. He really wanted to. He'd never done that, but I knew his sound would fit with what I had in mind. He kind of does Appalachian folk punk music, so it fits perfectly with the outlaw vibe. And again, I got to collaborate with him. Like, I wrote some lyrics that he put music to, but I had a sense of gelling with the style. I actually sing in one of the songs. He allowed me to do a cover of Duran Duran's "Hungry Like a Wolf."
That I rewrote. There you go. Well, I was going to ask you.
And I sing in that. That's my vocal debut as a singer.
I was going to ask you what your favorite song was, because actually in the whole CD, I loved the cover of Hungry, Hungry Wolf. At first, I thought it was just Hungry Like the Wolf, and then I started listening to the lyrics. I'm like, slip under the fence, da-da-da-da-da. I'm like, oh, man,
he
wrote this song.
Under the fence, the farmers are tense. Yeah.
I was like, that's some genius writing. Like.
So I got to do a bunch of stuff with the lyrics, but and then John did most of it. John and his kind of collaborator BJ did a lot of the lyrics, and yeah, one of my favorite songs, "Knee in My Jeans," that's kind of like it, to me. It sounded like this classic song that should have been around for 50 years, but he wrote that. It has this sound like an old school, like people should really listen to it. They should get it. You can listen to it on Spotify, I think, too. So it's out there and everywhere. You can listen to music. It's easy to find.
So you guys should, like, tour that, like, get a band together, like, tour around, like, all these, like, intense clubs and bars where people are just, like, throwing beer bottles, like in the Blues Brothers or something like that. And, like, and then halfway through the set, you should come out and be like, and now I have a story. And all these, like, adults should just, like, all right, man. Let's listen to him. And like you could like have a super like I could picture like especially at like Bonnaroo or Burning Man, people would eat that stuff up.
Well, we are gonna perform it at the Carnival de Resistance. We're having a small side tent. And I have a character named Oakbeard who's kind of just a whimsical carnival character of a tree mask. I'll do storytelling and then John's coming out and then we're acquiring a local band to kind of play some of the music, and we're just going to go for it. If we had more money, we could probably travel around more, but, you know, that kind of stuff is expensive. So
yeah,
we do when we can, yeah.
You got to make it work. Like, maybe, like, talk. Do you have any friends that are, like, in bands and stuff?
Not really.
I got a couple friends, and, like, it's always amazing to me how they just found ways to make money to support the tour. They'd sell shirts that they bought for, like, $2 for, like, $25, and, like, it was intense the ways they could find money, it seemed like. Yeah.
Yeah. I probably need to figure out how to do some of that. I'm not good at selling merch.
No?
No. Like, even when I go to places where I'm supposed to talk about my book, I'll forget to bring copies of my book.
Like, people are like, I really wish I could give you money. And you're like, no.
I don't have copies with me. It's happened a number of times, yeah.
All right, last question of the night. I think probably the most important question, and I didn't brief this question you at all beforehand, but I was just going to ask you, what's your kid think about this whole project? How is your own kid, you know, identified with you writing something? You mentioned him a bit as the inspiration. How did he like what his dad did for him?
Jonas is, he's kind of a mischievous kid, and he will never, like, tell me to my face that he likes it or not. He'll only tease me about not liking it, which I know means he does, and I'll catch him looking at it. I've caught him looking at it, and I've caught him listening to the music, and sometimes he'll ask, but he won't ever, like, praise it. Because it's just how we relate. But he's into it. He thinks it's great. I think he's trying to figure out whether or not the stuff I do is a big deal or not. He's not. He doesn't know if it's just, is my dad a big deal author? Or, like, I think that's where he's at.
You can tell him, according to this podcast, you're a big deal. I'm just going to say that. Just so the viewers know.
I'm going to show him this, and then he'll believe me. Because some man on the screen said so.
Well, a man from Canada, and we know things.
Canadians know things.
We do. We have maple syrup and things.
We also have maple syrup, but it doesn't taste as mapley as your
probably
maple
not.
Syrup.
I bet you it has more freedom, though.
It does. It
awful, kind of, bitter freedom.
Yeah, and it tastes kind of like blood and oil.
And on that note, how can you tell our audience to find you, Mark? Where do we find you? Do you have a Twitter? Do you have a website? Or are you on the interwebs?
I am on the interwebs. I search my name, Mark Van Steenwyck. I show up. I'm on Facebook. I'm on Twitter. I have a website, markvans.info. You'll find it all there.
All right. How often do you Google yourself? You said it shows up, so obviously at least once.
I've Googled. I used to have a Google alert set off for my name.
That's awesome.
Just because I was vain and wanted to know, but now I just know it's out there because, like, I mean, I put it there. I'm on social media and I have a website, so it's there.
There's just
not other Mark Van Steenwycks in the world, so it's pretty easy.
It's a pretty, like, Van Steenwyck is a pretty righteous last name. Sounds like you could be a pirate. And with the beard, I think that totally could go.
I always thought of myself as being some sort of baron living in a cold castle. The Baron von Steenwyck.
Yeah. Like, it would be German, or?
It's Dutch, but I'd say it more German-like, because that's just fiercer sounding.
Yeah, totally. Like, if you're going to be a baron, you got to be a German baron. Nobody's scared of a Dutch baron.
No, Dutch people are like nice wooden shoes and tulips. Germanists, please don't kill me.
Yeah, exactly. All right, so to our viewers, I want to wish you all a hearty good night. Tune in next week on Tuesday for Pastors in Exile, hosted by Ryan Robinson. And you can find more information about that at menonerds.com. If you want to look me up, my website is in the doobly-doo. My name is Paul Walker, and thanks for listening to all our viewers. Take care.